Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We actually want to cover what happened on Friday regarding the debates on the Constitutional Convention that actually occurred in Montana. Yours truly was there. Let me tell you up front, I was going to actually just be a opponent to, and then what ended up happening was I was placed into an informational person, or I forget what the technical term, because you could either speak to the opponent, or you could speak as a proponent for the Constitutional Convention, or you could be a subject matter expert. And so what I ended up doing was I got classified, and as the senator that I was working with didn't understand, or I didn't understand, I didn't speak up. Anyway, bottom line, they told me that, okay, you're an informational witness. So in other words, if there were questions regarding the Constitution or what was going on, but what ended up happening was it became really more of a focus between the John Birch Society and the Convention of States, instead of it becoming a dialogue on what is the problem and what are we trying to solve. whenever you actually are confronted with a situation where it requires action, do you, and 9 times out of 10, most people do actually just react. And sometimes that becomes a big mistake, especially if it is something that you're really not used to. But most people just have this, you know, attack or whatever mode, run. And in this particular case, this has been a repeated scenario in every state for several years. I mean, the Convention of State folks have been doing this for years and years and years, and currently they have 15 states. Now, let's just say, for an example, that the Convention of States has been working on trying to get states to submit a petition for an Article 5 convention to basically amend the Constitution. Okay, so, all right, with that, they've only got 15 states. Let's just give them 15 years. It means one state a year. That means that what they need is 19 more states. Do you believe, based on their current pace, we have 19 years for them to come and finally get to a point where they can fiddle with the Constitution? No, we don't. But more importantly, what we want to do is we want to actually cover all of these issues, and we want you to understand that as we cover these issues, we are going to lay out what the real argument should be. And the real argument should be an open and honest discussion, because if there is a deficiency, and what we're going to do, because I'm actually going to play the testimony. I want to play the testimony of the good senator that got behind this movement and how he believes that the Convention of States is the mechanism for dealing with federal tyranny. And Mark Meckler, the founder of the Convention of States, or I should say the principal guy behind this, and his arguments. And then we're going to play three different John Birch arguments. And what I want to do is I want to prove that none of them are really addressing the problem. As a matter of fact, I'll give credit to one individual who says, you know, we should be thinking, you know, alternatively what we can do, but then goes right into the narrative instead of actually talking about Republic Review. And oh, by the way, I'm going to tell you right now, this individual actually I know, and we've talked about Republic Review and has been very integral in ensuring that whenever I do a presentation, the John Birchers are there to try to discredit me instead of actually talking and debating Republicans, because they don't want to debate it, because they can't. They can't shut it down other than the fact that, oh, well, you know, we don't see it that way. They don't have a good argument. And so nobody has a good argument against Republic Review. And yours truly, you know, I probably have plenty of flaws that somebody can probably point out that, well, you know, in your book, you weren't really straightforward in your, because, and to be truthful, I didn't really understand the sensitivity of the Article 5 convention. And I also included some parameters that, you know, I thought that maybe we could get 2/3 of the states to join and go through that same process. But bottom line, as Madison laid out, Madison clearly pointed out that the states don't even have to petition. The states have it inherent. He didn't state that. He basically said, hey, we're not petitioning the federal government in his actions, in Jefferson's actions. They did not send an Article 5 petition. There was no even discussion. Hey, we need to amend the Constitution. What they talked about was clearly dealing with the breaches of the Constitution by the general government. And so what we want to do is I want to play these testimonies. What I want to do is, as we hear these testimonies, you're going to find that, and I'm not even going to play a lot of them because it was over 2.5 hours, but in today's show, I'm going to play the argument for the sponsor. I'm going to play the founder's argument. And these were supposed to be like 3-minute testimonies, which ended up being like 5-10 minutes. Anyway, but we have plenty of time to get through all of these. And then as we go through these, I'm going to try to highlight for you what really is being said and what really needs to be done. And so what I won't do is I won't interrupt. I'm going to actually just play these, and then I'll make a short commentary regarding what this person really said and what they didn't say. Okay? But what I do want to tell you is there was a very long line of proponents, people who were supporting the Convention of States, and every single one of them was pointing to the federal tyranny and what is wrong with the federal government, of how they're just overwhelming them with all of these unconstitutional laws, and the federal government is the problem. And so clearly they get that. They understand that, you know, the federal government is the problem. But the Constitution's not the problem. And this is where no one, not one person on the proponent side, those who were supporting the convention, say, not one person stated that the Constitution was the problem. They pointed to the Article 5 convention, and amending the Constitution was the process that was given them. Yeah, it's given to all of us to be able to amend the Constitution if the Constitution is the problem. Remember, I kind of went through this. There are 4 reasons why you would amend the Constitution. There's a deficiency with the Constitution. Secondly, if you want to grant more power to the federal government. Thirdly, if you want to take away the powers of the federal government, and very specifically to an Article 5 convention, pulling the states together, the only other reason for pulling the states together would be to rewrite or have a wholesale change to the Constitution. And so who's being honest? Who's being disingenuous? Who is being deceptive? And I will tell you, the way I see it, both sides are, because the argument has gone on and on and on, and you will actually hear, no, you won't hear it, because it was a rebuttal statement that came in later, but there was somebody on the opponent side that said, hey, there are 2 paths here, secession and nullification. Like, those are the only 2 paths, and they don't understand nullification. This shows the ignorance, or I should say ignorance, the illiteracy and the lack of true analysis and studying what the resolutions really did and what Jefferson and Madison's real intent behind those resolutions. So with that, what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and play the first segment. And this first segment was, like I said, this is the sponsor that is, you know, putting this, you know, I'll just say the rodeo together for everybody. So forgive me, I have to look over my shoulder to make sure I've got the selection highlighted. And so what I'm going to do is actually play this for you. So forgive me for, you know, having not perfect dynamics, but we'll hopefully through editing, we'll be able to fix the dynamic peaks if it's much louder or what have you. But just listen to what the argument is and why this guy's got behind supporting a convention of states.
So as I studied the convention of states idea, the more I studied, the more I was intrigued. The more I studied, the more I looked at it. I looked at the opponent's arguments from people you hear from today, the John Birch Society. I studied their arguments. I studied other arguments. I read footnotes in books that I read. I read Harvard Law Reviews and Florida Law Reviews of all the history of the conventions of states in America. I looked at every single of the 30 or so conventions of states in the United States in our founding era, see what they said, what their commissions were, what their instructions were, and what they did. And I had an epiphany during that search, and the epiphany was this. I've been involved in the legislature for 16 years. 8 of them I served in the House. Next 8, I took a very active interest in what was going on. And as a state legislator and as a conservative, I have pushed back against federal overreach and against federal deficit spending, which we vicariously spend about half of our budget in Montana on. And I pushed back. And an epiphany was that Article 5, the Convention of States, the Convention for Proposing Amendments, is our state's legislatures, our opportunity to have a serious impact on what happens in Washington. I don't have to go to Washington. We and this committee here have the power and the ability, along with other states in this country, to say to Washington, enough. Through Article 5, the founders gave us a tool to push back, and if we don't, we are culpable and complicit in what happens in Washington. So with that, members of the committee, I'm going to leave you with Article 5. I gave you all a constitution that you can open up and read it, because some of us don't. And the people behind me are going to be proponents, and they are going to share with you their deep conviction that this is the peaceful, constitutional, well-thought-out solution to the serious issues that create a delicate and critical situation in our nation, Mr. Chair.
And so to really point out that, first off, the focus for this sponsor was to push back and to deal with federal overreach. Well, amending the Constitution is not solving federal overreach. And that's why I played my argument first on Friday, as I was already engaged in that, that testimony, that hearing, what have you, that committee meeting. And so I understand. And so, I'll just say this, that people feel desperate. People truly feel like there is no other choice. There is no other alternative to what to do today. And so forgive me again, I'm looking over, I'm getting ready to cue up the founder here. But clearly, he was pointing to the Article 5 Convention as if the Article 5 Convention was the silver bullet to getting the federal government to behave, to not be doing all of the things that it's doing. As I pointed out, the 11th Amendment is being violated. And actually, the 11th Amendment was even brought up as a as proof that the states would stand up and assert their rights. But there was no, it was actually dishonest and deceitful and disingenuous for the person, I believe it was Mark Meckler, that pointed out the 11th Amendment. And he didn't tell anybody, well, by the way, that thing has been violated well before the 14th Amendment, because in bankruptcy cases, they already stepped over the 11th Amendment. And so, as I point out, the 11th Amendment abrogated, it actually overcame these and drew the line that you can't use bankruptcy laws, you know, to actually stretch over these things when the states have asserted in an amendment process, when the states have asserted their sovereignty, you can't go against that anyway. But what he said was, oh, see, there was another case where, you know, we actually, you know, pushed back on the judiciary and asserted our sovereignty over this particular case. And I'm going, does he not know that this is another part of the Constitution that the federal government has been violating? Anyway, so let me just go ahead and I will play what Mr. Meckler has to say, and then we'll start going into what the John Birchers have to say. Now, again, listen to what he's saying. Tell me where he's identifying the deficiencies, the powers needed, or the powers that must be taken away. They're not talking, they're not identifying any of those three reasons. And so remember, the underlying reason why you'd need to pull the states together is really that fourth reason, which is to make wholesale changes to the Constitution. So if they can't identify a deficiency and they can't identify a power that they want to give or a power within the Constitution they want, remember, even though they don't have the power for the EPA, education, and all those are violations. You don't create a negative against these powers. They don't have the positive to have jurisdiction or even to exercise these powers. The states are obligated. And this goes back to my argument how the Bill of Rights was more harmful than helpful, because the Bill of Rights made people think that, oh, well, we've got them pinned into a box. And that actually proves otherwise. So here's Mark.
I had the great honor of traveling the country. I've been in 48 states and the legislatures in most of those states. And I will tell you, being in those legislatures, being here in Montana today is what actually is the only thing giving me hope for our nation today. The state legislatures are filled with real public servants, people who are here for the right reasons, not for money, not for fame, not for power, but because they care about their states. And they've taken an oath to their state constitution and the United States Constitution. Today in America, all of that is at stake. I think people agree with this regardless of what side of the aisle they're on. We're seeing incredible division, perhaps the greatest division we've ever seen in modern America. And everybody, regardless of the side of the aisle or the political ideology, is concerned about what's going on in the country today. I'm here to tell you that the only solution that I'm aware of today in the United States of America that can solve the big problems facing our country is Article 5. Our problem is we're so divided as a nation. And we do everything or so many things in Washington, D.C. Roughly 60 to 65% of your state budget is controlled in Washington, D.C. And with a divided nation, what that means is roughly 50% of us are always angry about what's going on in Washington, D.C. The founders had a solution for this. They called it Article 5. The founders told us back in 1787 that if we got to the point where we felt like the federal government was doing too much, was too involved, was too tyrannical, not by party, but by institution in Washington, D.C., that we should call an Article 5 convention and we should take our power back. We should return it to the states. People are concerned, and rightly concerned, that we live in a nation where people don't really like each other. But the true history of our country is we haven't always really liked each other. In 1787, we joined together because we fought a common foe. But you move forward through history, we fought a civil war. We've always disliked and distrusted each other between states. And the only thing that made it work is that we had a federal government that was designed to do a limited amount of enumerated things, the things that we believe that we had to do together in a dangerous world to be successful as a nation. Today, the federal government has far exceeded those bounds. Regardless of party, we are frustrated by Washington, D.C. But we do have the power. You have the power to do something extraordinary. You, as state legislators, are extraordinarily imbued with power. You're not told this when you get your orientation here, but you are the only people in the federal government with the power to call a convention, to propose amendments, and to ratify those amendments, thereby restructuring the United States government and bringing the power back to the people in the states. Why you? Why were state legislators given this power? And I think the answer is obvious when you look at history, because those who served in the convention in 1787 were state legislators. They served in state legislatures, colonial legislatures. They served on town councils and county boards. So why did the founders give them the power? Why them and not somebody in Congress? And the reason is because the founders didn't trust you any more than they trusted people who would be in Congress. They understood human frailty and human flaws and human nature better than almost anybody. What they did is they trusted people more who were close to the people that they governed. Nowhere is this more true than in the Montana legislature. You go home and you live with your constituents. You live the same lives that they do. You're not insulated from them. You're not separated from them. They can come here and see you here. They can see you at home. And they do see you at home. In church, on the ball field, in service organizations. And the founders knew that someday the federal government would grow out of control and it would take state legislators to step up to the plate and rein it in. That's what we're asking you to do today. In summary, one of the things you're going to hear that there's going to be a runaway convention and we are going to lose our government if we allow there to be a convention. It's very important that you understand two things. One, we've lost our government. If you think you have any control over what goes on in Washington, D.C. today, the control is the other way around. They control us as individuals and they control your state, 60 to 65% of your budget. Number two, and equally important, the idea of a runaway convention is a fallacy. It's actually a fallacy that was invented in the 1970s by the radical left to stop conservatives who were trying to do important things to limit the growth of federal government. And you don't have to believe me. This is all on our website. Read David Horowitz's article about this. He's the great scholar of the American left. It's also important to remember who supports this and who doesn't support this. Because sometimes I can't know the politics of everything, so I just look to who supports it. Every major conservative figure in the United States of America has commented on this. All the talking heads, Limbaugh, Levin, Shapiro, Hannity are all in favor. All the scholars, Randy Barnett, Robbie George, and right here from Montana, Rob Nadelson. And on the other side is, frankly, every radical left-wing group in America signed a press release approximately 4 years ago against convention of states. So I'll close with that. The idea is that you have to choose a side at this point. And you have to make your choice between Montana or the federal government in Washington, D.C. I'm here to tell you that I choose Montana, and I hope that you will choose to support SJR, too. Thank you for your time.
Okay, so really quick, what I want to do is I want you to understand that he makes it really an ultimatum, either convention of states or you lose. And it's it's not even a black and white issue. When it comes to sovereignty over a compact, and obviously, there's reasons why he's in this position, first off. He was very focused on the amendment as the solution. And he was very well at pointing out that the federal government was doing too much and that the obvious thing is that you must do what he wants you to do, to convene a convention. Why not mention the resolutions? Why did he not? And I'm going to tell you, because Thomas Woods wrote a book on nullification. Go read that book and you will find that Thomas Woods does not talk about the interposition and what Madison clearly stated in his 1800. Why didn't he even read those and cite those? It was all about state nullifying. I'm here to tell you that there are reasons why people do not want to solve this problem, because this is a billion-dollar industry. Go look at the election process and you tell me how much money is poured into and actually sustains the media organizations, because they get billions of dollars in running advertisements. On a four-year cycle, it's definitely in the tunes of billions, because it's how they play our politics. You have to understand that Mr. Meckler and those who are involved in the convention of states that are actually going around arguing to do this, they're being paid. This is their job, to create this convention. Why? Why is it that they don't care about solving the problem? Because that's their job. I mean, 9 times out of 10, most people never question why they're doing what they're doing. And I'm going to point to you to that old interview I did with Sheriff Mack, when Sheriff Mack was out and he actually had a moral moment, an epiphany, when he pulled over a lady, you know, that was absolutely poor, barely able to get, and this was in the 80s, I believe, and he recognized that here's a woman that couldn't afford this ticket. She could barely afford to, you know, keep her kids, you know, properly clothed and so forth. I mean, she was struggling. And this was in the downturn and so forth. And he was thinking, what is his job? Is his job to just enforce, or is his job to inflict? To inflict the law upon others. Because when you start understanding police and law enforcement, it is all about revenue. If it was the moral high ground, and what we wanted to do was change behavior, or at least have a law to say, this is wrong, and we're not going to, then why ticket people? Oh, well, because when we make a financial impact, then they will learn their lesson. Bull crap. I am here to tell you, and I've talked about this, and I'm going to go into this really quickly because this is where it fits. Why is it that when a poor person has a DUI, their bond is greater than what they can bear? But when an elitist, a rock star, or let's just say a football player, a quarterback from some big Super Bowl team has a DUI, he's out of jail just like that. Because our penal system has a flat rate that actually hurts the poor and does nothing to the elitist. This is why I have said that if somebody behaves badly and you want to create a bond and you want to say drunk driving is bad, then why is it that we have a flat rate on what that infliction of pain is for your behavior? You should basically look at what that football star's annual salary is, and that's what his bond rate should be, the same as what the individual who can't pay. Okay, that's your annual salary rate, then this is what you have to pay. And no more plea deals and no more giving backs in communities, because they don't offer those types of things to the poor. We have an unjust system that favors the elite. And so these folks that are involved in trying to sell you the convention favors them, and they want you to focus on, you got to do this, you got to do this. Never once has a state actually had an open debate in pulling in the minds that can challenge the concepts. I'm not talking about, because to be honest with you, when you look at those who are against the convention of states, like the John Birch Society, well, why? What's in it for them? Well, because they're going to educate you out of this, right? I mean, that's been their premise all along since the 50s. They are going to educate us out of this problem. Same thing with a lot of other organizations that are opposing without any idea. Let's just call it the status quo. I am here to tell you that both sides of this debate has something in it for them. As I have pointed out to you, any conservative entertainer and anybody involved in this process has no interest whatsoever to solve the problem. Why? Because they're making money off of all of this. Now, I'll give credit to Meckler. He's absolutely correct that the state legislators do have the power because it is their constitution. As Madison stated, they are the parties to it. And this is why we read this all the time to you, that when you're the parties, you are the final judges. If it is your contract, now, if it is a contract that is, you know, falls under labor law or those types of things, then it goes to the courts. But as Madison said, there is no court greater to this Constitution than the states themselves to deem and determine and to judge how their contract has been violated. Sorry about the open mic with the last one. But now we're going to get into this is an opponent to this constitutional convention. And again, I have to turn my head here real quick. This is an opponent, and this is, I believe, the first John Bircher. And there's going to be three. This one, the next one, and the next one, the final one, because I've got three. And I wanted to show how they are not talking about other alternatives. It is either this is too dangerous, the procedural problems, but they don't talk about, yes, we have a real problem and we need to face it. They kind of admit to the fact, and you'll hear them admit, yes, we've got a problem, but this is not how to do it. And they have no idea how to do it. Or do they? Because I have sent Republic Review to Appleton years ago and asked them to take a formal position. And what do you get when you don't get a position? You get their answer. They would choose not to solve the problem and have this debate. And I have asked And I have asked and asked, and I tell anybody and everybody, anybody listening to my words, you should challenge, because I'm challenging the John Birchers, I'm challenging the Eagle Forum, everybody who has skin in this game, the Convention of States, and everybody else, anybody who has skin in this game, let's meet at a table and let's really identify what all the problems are. We can put them up on a board, the EPA, education, all these social programs. And as a matter of fact, what I'll do is I'll audit it for them, just like Jefferson did in his resolutions. And I will lay this all out, because it's irrefutable. The states do have the power, as Madison stated. Madison was 100% correct. And Madison, as the father of the Constitution, and people even cite Madison as the father of the Constitution. And they use him to support their means, but they do not dare open up the dialogue to any alternative thinking. We are locked in a proponent and opposition to and fro, and you can't think otherwise. Or can you? I think it's time that the states wake up and realize they have been played. They are being played, because there is money in this on both sides. When an organization who pays people to do their job, like the John Birchers and others, and this is why the Eagle Forum is one organization that I actually have presidents that are supporting Republic Review and think, yeah, absolutely, this is not a danger to the Constitution, as they have researched it and have looked into it and even had their experts look into it. They've all agreed. So here we go, and this will be the first, like I said, this is the first John Bircher to come forth and provide their input. And so here we go.
I stand here in agreement with all of the people who have already spoken. I stand in opposition to the methodology. I have a story to tell. It's a very personal, deeply personal story. Just over a year ago, I was forced to leave my very prosperous and stable home of Chile for the previous 7 years. Due to very sudden and violent civil unrest happening all around me in the city of Santiago, worse than anything we've seen here in the United States, that had just begun 2 months prior in October of 2019. Only 8 days after the start of the riots, 1 million people came out into the streets to protest every social and economic issue imaginable. With that, so very surprisingly, came a sudden call for a new constitution. I asked everyone who was for this what specific language in their constitution could they blame for these issues. None could tell me, but all were convinced that it was the cause of their problems and their injustices. After 6 weeks of massive destruction of property and chaos, to be specific, $2 billion in damages, President Piñera finally agreed to a referendum for a new constitution. I still trying to understand how such a peaceful and prosperous nation could suddenly turn to chaos. I asked my very many Venezuelan friends who had been forced to leave their country, formerly very prosperous nation, to find work elsewhere so they could feed their families back home. And now, having bought homes and developed businesses in their new country of Chile, what they thought of this situation going on. Every single one of them told me that this is how the loss of their country began. They shared with great shame that they had been the protesters demanding the changes to their constitution and supporting all who promised them change. They admitted to having voted for Cesar Chavez and then admitted that they had brought their misery and loss upon their country, upon themselves. I asked them what they would do about this situation in Chile. They said that they were desperately trying to warn the Chileans to not fall for the promises made by the politicians and by the agitators. I asked them how the Chileans were responding to their warnings, and they said they responded the same way that they had responded to the Cubans who came to warn the Venezuelans. They said, we wouldn't fall for those false promises. We're Venezuela, we're not Cuba. And the Chileans are saying, we're not Venezuela, that would never happen to us. And now we see something similar happening in this country. Now, after it's all too late, they have lost their country and are forced to live and work in a new one. And they do very deeply regret their actions and their trust in promises made to them. Chile just had their election this past October for their referendum for a new constitution. And very surprisingly, although it was not to me, almost 80% of the voters have placed their faith in a new and yet unwritten constitution. The likelihood of it solving their problems is doubtful, and the possibility of it bringing about the downfall of their nation is very real. But what the heck? It's what the people are asking for, right? I know you're not asking for a new constitution, but you're seeking ways to constrain the out-of-control federal government by changing the wording to a document that has not been abided by for a very long time. You may believe that you can control this convention process and impose your state's powers over Congress. Article 5 grants you the power to apply for a convention. This application is then given to Congress to call for the convention. If they call for it, they control it. To think that Congress would hand over the power to the states to restrain itself is a terribly naive belief. You, our representatives, hold the preservation of what's left of our horribly ignored and abused founding document. This key has so far been very, very carefully guarded for 233 years. The enemy of this great document would like nothing more than for you to bring out that key and unlock the door. Your intention is to only and carefully and with great limitations crack the door open, make the repairs, and then close the door again. There are, however, powerful enemies that are hoping that you'll do just that so that they can kick down the door and destroy the few restraints that still hold them back. If you can guarantee that this cannot and will not happen, I would consider supporting you. But you know you can't. I ask you, can you live with yourself if you, like the well-intended Cubans and Venezuelans and Cuban people, open the door themselves and in the end made a disastrous decision that cost them their once prosperous nations and forced them to go live somewhere else? Is it worth the risk? Is there a reason that this has never been attempted before in 233 years? I implore you to oppose this resolution and seek other solutions to this very real problem that we are facing. Thank you.
All right. So, and I have to apologize. I sometimes have, in the previous one, I had an open mic and ended up coughing. So forgive me. What you just heard was a very emotional and very, you know, passionate plea for not doing this. But what you did not hear was the opposition to the cure. In other words, here we have a problem of federal overreach and all of these federal violations to the Constitution. But you do not hear any clear articulation that this is not the cure. The Constitution, again, an amendment to the Constitution is to fix a deficiency, to give a role or take a role away. That it is within the Constitution. You're only changing the contract. You can do these things. You can't do this thing anymore. These are the only things you can do. Well, that doesn't change the that doesn't change the behavior of the government. The government has already gone down this point through their soothsaying and unconstitutional court system. Truly, an unconstitutional court system and an unconstitutional federal government that has aggrandized themselves. So this is how the states are constantly being led into federal court over an issue that the federal courts have no jurisdiction over. This is why we go through the ratification debates to prove that the federal court's jurisdiction is limited to the enumerated powers. If it's about life, it's not a federal issue. If it's about the environment, education, housing, race, anything like that. All of these acts, all of these laws, and every power that they're exercising in social engineering are all unconstitutional. So it is the biggest mistake states make in going to the court system to get them to abide by the Constitution when, again, the courts have already won because you have surrendered your sovereignty by allowing them to be the judge and arbiter. This is why the state legislators must actually take a stand as Jefferson and Madison called for in 1798, and not call for a convention, and not sue the federal government. What they did was they called for the states to interpose. Now, what they may have not understood and what they didn't have in 1798 is they didn't have Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But now let me get into the next testimony that is another John Bircher. And this is the guy that actually understands. We've talked about Republic Review. He has a radio show. I was on his radio show that talked about Republic Review. At that point in time, he was actually all for it. Now that he's getting paid by the John Birch Society, he's attacking the concept, not on the merits of Republic Review and the academic argument for it. Yours truly. As a matter of fact, what they did, and I've got the audio, and I'll bring it to the table one of these days, but this particular show is focused on how wrong this dialogue and narrative is, because they don't want you to understand that the states have all the power over this contract to enforce their contract. So with that, let me kind of just lean over here and get this started. Here we go.
Let me lay out a scenario for you. Say that I am not feeling very well and I decide to go to a doctor, and after some tests are taken, I just found that I have high blood pressure. Well, like most Americans, my initial response is going to be, what type of medications can you give me? But the reality is this, what I should be asking is, how can I fix this with diet or exercise? In my opinion, the con is a quick fix. And what I have found in my 42 years of life is that anyone that says they have a quick fix is attempting to sell me something. This constitutional convention has the potential for a runaway convention. And I have heard people saying that that is not a risk. But let me ask you another question. How did this most recent election go? This election that was guaranteed to be without fraud and to be truthful and honest, and something that the American people could rely on. And yet, about half of Americans believe that the election was stolen. The con has the potential for nefarious people to get involved and to push agendas that will not promote the American way. As an example of this, I point to Washington State, where we currently have a Wolfpack con bill. It's 8002. Now, this Wolfpack is funded by George Soros. That is correct, Dr. Evil himself. This is someone who does not believe in the principles of American liberty. This is someone who wants to drastically change America into a nation that you and I will no longer recognize. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, was very wary of another con taking place. He wrote about this. You can look it up. The truth of the matter is, Article 5 is not the solution. Article 6 is a solution. Article 6, where we demand that our representatives uphold their oath to defend the Constitution.
So with that, we don't have enough time to play the final segment. And this is another academ that goes down the path. And I'll give credit to Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown actually dives into the precedents and history and those types of things, which is always good. It's always nice to have the understanding of history and precedents. But what he completely, completely disregards is, what did Madison and Jefferson actually do when the Constitution was being violated? And we're actually looking at federal violations today that go hand in hand. And I mentioned this on my Friday show, that what Biden is doing in targeting those people that are those people who are actually demanding compliance of the Constitution as domestic terrorists. And so they're creating even a deeper level of sedition and hate acts and identifying yours truly and anybody that's taking a stand. And they won't go after anybody that is doing the what I'll just call controlled opposition, because that's what we see going on in these debates. It's all controlled opposition. They don't want you to actually have an open and honest dialogue. They don't want anybody to stand at that table and challenge the status quo. And right now, the status quo has two sides to it. We got to amend the Constitution. We got to open it up. And if anybody sees this as a danger, then they're not being honest if they don't talk about how to deal with breaches of the Constitution performed by the federal government. Clearly, and I'm going to read this because Madison actually cited this out of Thomas Jefferson's notes on the states of notes on the state of Virginia in 1784. This came out of his book, and this is how he starts off Federalist Paper number 49. The author of, quote, Notes on the State of Virginia, close quote, quoted in the last paper, has subjoined to that valuable work the draft of a constitution which had been prepared in order to be laid out before a convention expected to be called in 1783. So in other words, when he wrote this portion of the book, this was back in 1783. By the legislature for the establishment of a constitution for that commonwealth, the Commonwealth of Virginia. The plan, like everything from the same pen, marks a turn of thinking, original, comprehensive, and accurate, and is more worthy of attention as it equally displays a fervent attachment to republican government and an enlightened view of the dangerous propensities against which it ought to be guarded. Again, this is Federalist Paper number 49. One of the precautions which he proposes on, which he appears ultimately to rely as a palladium to the weaker departments of power against the invasions of stronger, is perhaps altogether his own, and as it immediately relates to the subject of our present inquiry, ought not to be overlooked. His proposition is, quote, that whenever any two of the three branches of government shall concur in opinion, each by the voice of two-thirds of their whole number, that a convention is necessary for altering the Constitution, or, and then he capitalizes this, correcting breaches of it, a convention shall be called for that purpose. So in other words, he was actually identifying two separate conventions, Jefferson, and he was pointing out that there are conventions that deal with altering the Constitution, and then there are conventions that call for the dealing with breaches. Now, I am actually isolating these two as separate conventions. They are not Article 5 conventions. Why? Because Madison stated in his notes on the 1800 notes on the Virginia Resolutions dated 1800 January, quote, that where resort can be had to no tribunal superior to the authorities of the parties themselves must be the rightful judges in the resort. So in other words, this is why they did not call for an Article 5 convention. This is why Thomas Jefferson and James Madison called to pull the states together in Jefferson's term into a convention of states, not to amend the Constitution, not to petition Congress for an Article 5 convention, but to enforce the Constitution. This is not rocket science, but I'm telling you, I have been excoriated and I've been highlighted because I use the C word, convention. I am the bad guy, as court, according to the John, because, hey, he's used the word convention. He mentions convention. And so he really wants to change the Constitution, just like these evil guys over in the COS. I mean, that's their thinking. That's exactly how their logic, or at least that's how they want you to think instead of actually looking at what is going on. Are we dealing with a runaway government? And are they basically saying that a convention to amend the Constitution would be runaway? then why solve a runaway problem with another runaway? Why not actually just deal with the problem by enforcing the Constitution? As Madison clearly stated, he clearly stated that the states, then being the parties to the constitutional compact and in their sovereignty capacity, it follows of necessity that there can be no tribunal above their authority to decide in the last resort. If you look at Republic Review, this is the epitome of what James Madison and Thomas Jefferson did. I challenge them to prove otherwise, but nobody wants to do that. They want to keep you locked into the paradigm that there is an Article 5 convention or the status quo. Give John Birch your money. Give the John Birch Society your money and buy their curriculum, because they get these great speakers to come and talk to you about the evils of what's going on in the education system, and they're not doing a thing in addressing this federal overreach and the unconstitutionality of this. Why? Because they're making money. They want to see the federal government continue to do this, because especially during Biden administrations, Obama, the money pours in because they get people convinced to thinking, you pay us, we will teach you out of this. And for an organization that's been working to teach the people out of this since the 50s, how close do you think we are? How close do you think we are of ridding ourselves with communism? Actually, the truth is we're seeing our federal government in the final throes of a communist revolution and implementing communism here in America. So how successful is this movement? How successful is this paradigm to continue to stay the course with their education? I am telling you, we have to break away, stop reading their crap, and stop reading their editorializing. Read these source documents. The source documents tell you very specifically what the federal government can do, what they can't do, and what the states can do, and what the states must do. You know, Madison clearly stated, this goes right into the, let's just call these the ratification, not the ratification phase. This is the initial quote in his 1798 resolution of Virginia, that in a case of deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercises of power not granted to the said compact, the states who are parties thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose, not to nullify, not to just say we're not going to enforce this, to interpose for arresting the progress of evil and for maintaining within their respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them. He went on and said in this same resolution in 1798, he says, doth solemnly appeal to the like dispositions of other states in confidence that they will concur with this commonwealth in declaring, as it does hereby declare, that the acts aforesaid are unconstitutional, and that he's not calling to nullify. And that the necessary and proper measures will be taken for each cooperating with this state in maintaining the authorities. In other words, in interposing and taking action, not nullifying. Anybody that has bought this concept, and you know what? I'd love to have the debate with Thomas Woods. I would like to see why Thomas Woods missed these words, why he didn't include Jefferson's lamenting of the 1799 resolutions, or why he completely left out Madison's perspective on the notes on the state of the resolutions of Virginia of 1798, what I just read. Anyway, we will wrap up this debate in our next episode, and we will actually come to some conclusions as to why we're in this situation and problem. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.